Hello and welcome to the Transcontinental Daily Podcast, Episode 6, with myself, Rob Quirk, and the esteemed Karen Tosti. Hey, Karen.
Hey, Rob. That's quite an introduction, but I'll take it.
Awesome, yes. Just a word from, we've got a new sponsor for this episode, Caniston. Keeping riders, undercarriages, free from saddle sores in all the ultras. For those of you who haven't been listening to previous episodes, you won't get that joke.
That's just yes. A small plug to go back to, I believe it was episode 4.
There we go. So, wow, the race is super hotting up at the moment. All the riders have flown into the Balkans. Unfortunately, we don't have Tom here to guide us, so me and Karen will be hosting ourselves and asking ourselves the questions. Don't worry, Tom will hopefully return tomorrow, but right now let's dive in and have a look at the shape of the race. For those who have been following, we're now watching the race leaders pushing hard across the Balkans. As we speak, I think in the last hour, as we're recording right now, we've seen Adam Balek pull into control point 3, and I think Ulrich, hot on his heels, is also just arriving. Control point 3, for those at home, is in Dermator, Montenegro. So Dermator is a beautiful national park, famous for undulating mountains. So not quite what you get in the Alps, where they seem to be quite pointy and sheer, was in Dermator. They're almost beautiful grasslands, but at immense altitude. And hot on the heels of Ulrich and Adam is, of course, Christoph Strasser, who, if I think we quoted him, he just had a really good quote where he couldn't believe the speed of the other people at the front of the race, but he said if anyone was to slip up, he was going to jump into that gap. And yes, it would seem that Robin Gempel, who was at one point the race leader, may have cracked, and Christoph has jumped straight in there. So, I mean, really exciting. What are your thoughts, Karen?
Yeah, it's really exciting seeing this slight change really in the rankings at the pointy end, and it's. Generally speaking, just amazing to see actually a relatively, in the grand scale of things, a relatively tight kind of top 20, top 30 or so. There's really quite a lot of people really going incredibly fast. So I was just kind of checking back on, you know, average daily distances. And so we've got Megan, so currently probably the third woman in 25th place, based on Follow My Tracker. So she's currently at 440 kilometers per day average. So that's how many days are we in now? We're in five days in, 440 kilometers a day average. And that puts you only in 25th place. So obviously we've got Adam and Ulrich who are doing about 500 kilometers a day. But to put that into perspective, even people who are back at the beginning of control point 2 parkour, so they've still been doing about 300 kilometers a day. So there's just a huge amount of people in this race that are really covering a lot of ground. It's contributing to there just being a lot of people that are up there. And as we've seen over the last 24, 48 hours, what might feel like a kind of done deal in terms of who's in the top few riders jostling for those kind of first, second, third places, actually that can change pretty quickly. And I don't know if we're seeing, you know, some of the kind of overuse injuries or kind of tiredness kicking in when people have come out of the blocks a bit too fast, essentially. And on the other hand, kind of experience and patience paying off. I think Christoph Strasser was sleeping a lot more than others, and kind of had an explicit strategy of not going too hard. And yeah, it seems to be massively paying off for him. We're also seeing Pav coming through. He's seems to have made a lot of gains on the rest of the field in the last 24 hours. It's been a bit hard to tell because he's been taking quite a different route to everyone else in that front pack. But again, it feels like, you know, Pav's done a lot of these events, and you wonder if there's kind of experience coming through now.
Well, I think, yeah, you've really touched upon it there with those numbers, because speaking to all the people who regularly follow this race, the most common thing everyone says is just how fast everyone is. And that's, I think that is quite unique. Something that we're seeing here is, like, if you look, normally you would have the race leaders quite far ahead of the rest of the pack. Whereas here, it's they're right up on the tail, and the distance that everybody's doing, but the sort of level, in the field, the quality of the riders, the legs that everybody has got is mind-boggling. And like you said, the top 25 is a constant jostle. All the positions moving. And we're seeing people crack, or we're seeing people jump up into those gaps. It's really, really very exciting. You also touched upon then the route choices that have been going on here, which I think this is another very interesting thing. Was right at the beginning of the race, we saw two very distinct directions that riders chose to go into CP1, and then everyone merged together. And again, now we're seeing three distinct routes develop. Any thoughts on what we're seeing here? Any advantages to the different routes people have decided to take?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So most people seem to be following the kind of mostly coastal route. There are a few people going a little bit more inland, and then really it's only been Pav, Fiona and Robert Webb that have taken this much more inland route, kind of cutting out east before dropping down south. And Rob, I'm interested to know your thoughts on this, because I know you've done a bit of riding around there, including in Durmitor, so I'm sure we'll come back to that in a minute. My sense is, as I mentioned earlier, Pav seems to have made really big progress on the front pack since we last spoke, so in the last 24 hours. And it could be just he's been having a good day, but my sense is potentially there was a fast road down there, and that's why some people have taken what looked like maybe a bit of a detour on the map to take that route. What's your thought on it, Rob?
Well, yeah, you're right. When I did the race, it was the very same parkour that was in. So control point 3, Durmitor, was exactly the same as when I did it. And we saw a similar thing where people picked two or three distinct ways to get there. What's actually slightly different is was most people, in addition, I did it, went through Mostar in Bosnia. That's where the split occurred, where you got riders who would either go north or south, or for those, myself included, who used Google Satellite, there was a very direct route straight across the border to Puzani, which is the start of the parkour in Durmitor. But that's like a crazy gravel track, which I imagine anyone who's made the connection to the 2016 race edition has probably read a few blogs or something and realized it's not a good idea to take that route. So this year is quite different, where you've got these outliers like Fiona, Rob and Pavel, who have taken the extreme north. Now, we did have a listener ask a question. I've misplaced his name. I'm really sorry. Do write in again to remind me. He was asking, why have we got these outliers doing this far northern route? Because although the distance all seems to be more or less the same within 20, 30 kilometers, the northern route actually looks like it adds on about 1,000 to 2,000 meters of extra climbing. This puzzled me as well. I was trying to work it out. So I plotted the routes into Komoot to look at the elevation profiles and the distance. And interestingly, yes, there is more climbing on the northern route, but it all comes in one hit, or a few smaller hits and then one big hit, with a huge descent into Pusani. Whereas if you take the coastal route, you're doing a constant up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. So much smaller climbs with a few big ones. But as a rider, this is quite an exhausting state to be in, because especially mentally, because even though you might be doing less vertical meters, you feel mentally that you do a small climb, but it still takes you like however long. You do a descent, and then the descent is over before you know it. And this really starts to play on you, because you just feel like you're constantly going up and you're never getting that down. Whereas the guys in the north, they will do a big climb at the end, really a couple of other fairly significant climbs, but then they will get the advantage of just being able to sit in the aero bars and really just fly along the flat to the control point.
I'm also looking and I'm wondering if there might be potentially a heat factor playing into people's thoughts. I don't know the area very well, but I'd imagine taking that coastal route, generally people are probably at a lower elevation above sea level. So I don't know if maybe there was also a thought for people go inland, got a bit more altitude potentially, avoiding some of the plains. But I might be putting my ignorance about that area's geography on display there. But just looking at the map briefly, I'm wondering if that could also be a factor.
Well, definitely Croatia is hot. So I'm not sure what the temperatures are now, but you would imagine they would definitely be in the high 20s to low 30s. And interestingly as well, it's probably going to be the biggest stretch that the riders will do without any significant resupply. So I remember it was about 70 kilometers that I had to do with no resupply through Croatia. And when it's that hot, you really have to think about how much water you've got on the bike there. So that could be another factor that would really slow down riders on the coastal route, whereas perhaps people further north actually have more resupply, less big climbing. So even though it might seem like the hard route, they really are flying along that. And as you can see from Pavel, I think he was able to gain two or three places taking that route. I mean, there's so many factors that come into play in your placing. Right now, it's really hard to guess anyway, because the top 10, the top 15, the top 20 is so tightly packed. It's like if anyone just oversleeps, slips up, misses a resupply, gets an injury, it's just everything can change. So, you touched on this before, actually, when we spoke about Megan Hakkinen and Amre Kune. But of course, we've got the top three women who are all jostling in the top 20 as well, which again, I think Obviously, Fiona won it last year, but I think this is very exciting because I don't think we've had it before where the top three women are in the top 20. Perhaps, I mean, I could be wrong here, and please, you know, let me know if I am, but this is another factor of why, you know, this year's race is so very exciting because we're really seeing a lot of new and unique things that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, it's really awesome to see, and I think Megan and Amri are definitely in that group of kind of the chasing group that seem to be making pretty good progress at the moment. So yeah, as we mentioned earlier, Fiona, having said the kind of north and then south route seems to have worked really well for Pav, feels like Fiona's stalled a bit over the last 24 hours. She's taking that similar route, but seems to have dropped back. So I don't know if she's had a long rest or, yeah, not sure what's going on there. But it does look like, and obviously things can change because it can be a bit deceptive when you've got people on different on the kind of different route pathways, but Megan and Amre are following a pretty similar route. Amre seems to actually just be having a nice time at the beach based on the map. She's gone right on the coast, whereas everyone else is a bit more inland from her. They're really, you know, it's just a kind of a couple of hours sleep's worth of distance between them, and it's really awesome to see three women really up there just flying and kind of giving the guys a good run for their money. So it's interesting. I just yesterday, Becky and I were saying how Fiona's lead just seemed really, really comfortable over Amre and Megan, and felt kind of relatively unchallenged. But it just goes to show how quickly that can change, because I think that's really not the situation anymore. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next 24 hours. Obviously, people are in different patterns of sleeping and refueling and whatever. So it's constantly shifting around. But yeah, just great to see that tussle taking place.
I mean, as the crow flies, they are almost within the same distance. All three of them are control point three. It's really heating up. I love it. I love it. It's so exciting. So go on.
Rob, yeah. Can I put a question back to you? So obviously we've been talking a lot about control point three. We've talked a bit about Dermator, but could you tell us a bit more about that? Because you rode TCR number four in 2016 when it was the same control point and the same parkour. Could you just give us a bit of a sense of what that road is like and what Adam and Ulrich will be embarking on as we speak?
So it's well, there's a few things that might change my experience to what a lot of other riders had. First of all, was, you know, I took that gravel, the direct gravel road to get to Puzzany, which really, really reduces distance. It like turns maybe something like a 100-kilometer ride into a 30-kilometer ride.
Oh wow!
But I paid
30-kilometer walk, having, maybe.
Yeah. Well, you know, I ended up double puncturing on the gravel road, and I didn't realize I'd actually slipped the sidewall of my tire. So every time I put a tube in, I'm like, oh, well, good to go, ride, and I'd puncture again. So it ended up I had to basically walk to the control point. And I had a lot of screaming into the hills in the middle of nowhere on this like long forgotten border crossing that, you know, probably only farmers use now. But then when I did finally get to the control point, I always remember Anna was manning the control point. You know, we had nice little boost when you get there. I sort of refueled. The sun was going down and it was like, okay, well, let's go and do this. And I think this was actually one of the best decisions I made in my race, and why Dermatour became so significant is, you know, I did the parkour at night when it was dark. So essentially I did the climb when it wasn't hot. So even though it's astoundingly beautiful up there, I've looked at photos. I had a completely different experience, and I actually ended up from going from definitely, being around to position 180, I managed to do that climb around the 40th fastest rider. So it made a huge difference doing it at night.
Because you weren't just baking in the heat.
Exactly. But I was lucky enough to do the start of the parkour as the sun was going down. And anyone who's been there will tell you, like, this place is most beautiful at sunset, because you start off going, it's a huge lake, but with these bridges that cross the lake. So you're actually right, and the bridge is low, the lake is low, but you're in between mountains. And then when you cross the bridge, you start riding up the mountain road where they've just blasted tunnels through the rock. But it's not like in the Alps where you get all this nice concrete on the inside. It's literally blasted rock and that's it. So there's no dressing or anything. And even like there's huge potholes in the road, which, so as you're going through the tunnels, you have to have your light on. Because the pitch black, there's no light, and if you don't have your light on, you risk just like going into one of these potholes that literally could swallow you from wheel. So once you get that out of the way and you're climbing up through these tunnels, and then you look back and you can see this body of water and the whole sky is pink at dusk and stuff, it's stunning. And I mean, the whole park is full of wild horses and things like this, so you have this. I mean, I came across them at night, so it was like this surreal dream. I mean, the whole race becomes a surreal dream, doesn't it? Because you're just in this whole
delirious.
Yeah, exactly. So and we're hitting dusk now, and there are several riders who are coming up onto that control point. Adam and Ulrich have started the parkour. Christoph is pulling in. Pavel's not far behind. So I reckon we probably will see a few people doing that climb. Right at the top, you come into a ski resort, which is excellent for hotels. It does get very cold because it's very high. Hopefully, I hope some riders will do that night, because it is a unique experience.
Amazing. My bike ride this morning around York was also equally as exciting, I'm sure.
Well, York's very beautiful. Right. Well, we're lucky enough to have intel on the ground as the race is happening. So as Ulrich and Adam passed through the control point just within the last hour, we got a couple of quotes from on the ground. Do you want to read Adam's?
Sure. So Adam has said, "What's happening this year is really special. What's happening in front is just amazing. We're going so fast and no one wants to lose ground. The fact we're all so close together, I couldn't imagine anything like this. This makes things much more exciting."
Which, yeah, exactly, sums it up perfectly. And then I think within half an hour, Ulrich passed through and they grabbed a quote from Ulrich. Who said, "We are 2,700 kilometers into a race, and we are chasing each other all the time on different routes, and we are coming back together again. So to be so close, unbelievable." Well,
it's amazing to see them both just like reveling in the race so much, you know? They're just, it's just really great to see. like the challenge, they're clearly kind of spurring each other on, and I guess the chasing group as well. As you said, there's quite a few people that are increasingly hot on their heels. Yeah, it's the awesome thing to see.
I can't believe is Ulrich was complaining about knee pain, like literally since the start of the race, and it doesn't really seem he's either like gonna really pay for that afterwards, or maybe it's not as bad as, you know, but he's pushing on through. So yeah, I mean, just awesome to see. Okay, on to formalities now. So we've sort of talked about the race leaders, the women's race. And now, as we predicted, there's been quite a large list of people who have scratched from the race. I think we are on the sixth day of the race, so almost a week in. So you can expect there's going to be a number of people who start to crack. Do you want to read the scratches?
Yeah, okay, we'll try and do it in one breath. I don't think it's going to be possible. Sebastian Brouwer, 210. Daniel Jacobus Marsman, 222. He was an early race leader, but seems to be out now. Niels Yeinti, 175. James Kirk, 162. Craig Edwards, 96. Pierre Cotin, 190. Cara Dixon, number 3. Ketil Wendelbo Enensen, 148. Mattis Chimelo, 239. Doing some more of the butchering of everyone's names. Apologies, everyone. Jens Hortzmann, 139. Tom Dockal, 227. Barry Duplock, 90. Holger Pfingsten, 128. Rose McGovern, 136. Wendy Ellis, 09. Christoph Gotz, 104. Matthias Sante, 167. Gianluca Morini, 69. Danny Shafrir, 154. And last but not least, Hashin Hassan, number 200, who I think, along with Amre, was one of the Michael Bursary riders. No scratches from the pairs, as far as we know. So yeah, that's a really long list. Becky and I were reflecting yesterday how there were only three scratches, and we were wondering why that was, and maybe it's because they were saving themselves up for the bumper crop today.
Yeah, so yeah, quite a big chunk. But still, I think compared to previous years, this is still quite a small number in total of scratches. I think that's very interesting. Perhaps it's something that comes with, as the race becomes more mature, people really get a better sense of what to expect.
Yeah, interesting. And do we know much about why people are scratching? The ones I've been having a dig around to try and find out, and every person who scratched that have been able to find out information about, it's been because of essentially an overuse type injury. There's a couple of Achilles, a couple of knees. Sebastian Brouwer was one of those who scratched because of his knee. And just, he put quite a nice quote actually on his Instagram, which I thought sums up a lot about the race actually. And yeah, so he says, it's a long distance race like the TCR is not something you can do on the side. Even as European or German mountain bike champion, you have to learn new skills because it's not just about power. I don't regret the end. I appreciate it very much. My goal was to find my physical and mental limits. I've pushed these further back and finally found them. So yeah, he's unfortunately had to scratch because of knee injury, but I think that sums up so much about the race and what it puts people through and what people get out of it. So even though all that long list of people that are scratching, you know, they'll still hopefully have got a lot out of the experience, and scratching is by no means a failure.
No, not at all.
It's part of the course when you do these kinds of things.
Exactly. I think that quote from Sebastian also really illustrates, and we will be touching on this point again with the listeners' questions later in the podcast, but Sebastian, who, for those who don't know, he's a European and German MTB champion. So his physical fitness, you can imagine, is going to be really up there with some of the best. And I think that's what a lot of people expect. You know, people always ask me, it's like, how do you ride that far every day? But I think the question always revolves around, you know, a physical, on the idea of like, how can you physically do it? And my response is often, it's like, well, you know, if you can ride 200K, you can even ride 100K, you can probably ride an ultra, because you're not going full whack all the time, you know. But the thing that really, really challenges you is your mental limits. And yeah, and I think a lot of the time that comes with experience. Obviously, some people maybe have a mental fortitude straight in, who, you know, don't necessarily need the experience. They're just they maybe have a stronger fortitude. Yes, I like that word. I'm gonna use that more.
But it's not just about the mental strength, right? It's also about kind of how you've approached the race. I think you can be incredibly strong-willed, but still, if you've gone out too fast and you've burnt yourself out, or you've given yourself an overuse injury, there's only so much that the mental strength can get you through. Having said that, Ulrich is riding one-legged, so
yeah. Exactly.
Where there's a will, there's a way, maybe. I'm not sure.
I mean, this is what is quite interesting, because Sebastian, he was a favourite to win, potentially. Daniel Jacobus Marsman, he was the race leader for much of the first and second day, I think. Is that right? So you can be right up there. I'm really... you're one of the big hitters, but you know, it's not just about your physical prowess. Christoph Strasser is, I really like that quote, where he's like, yeah, this is my limit, and so I'm going to cycle within my limit, basically, is what he's saying. And you know, he's pulling into a strong third place. Third, I think. Yep. And he's pulling into the parkour as we are getting very close. He's within 20K of the parkour. So, what's been going on in the world of social media? Well, there's been a lot. There's always a lot of ice lollies and ice creams being eaten. What's quite nice is we're coming full circle back to day one of the race I think it's pronounced Jorge Cordell Lorenzo, but I was told he likes to be called George. It's Cap 215. He, on the first day of the race, he got back-ended by a truck in Brussels, so... Not even really the first day. I think it was within the first few hours. And he lost, I think it was 14 hours in total, getting his wheel fixed or repaired. But he's slogging away. There's a nice little quote there. Do you want to read that, Karen?
Yeah. At the back of this race and getting my ass kicked, it's beautiful.
Exactly. So he's definitely, especially with the scratches that have happened today, he's definitely close to being the Lantern Rouge. I don't think he's quite the last rider yet?
No, I don't think so. But I think he was one of the group that missed control point one. I think he just couldn't quite recover after that incident, if I'm correct. But seems to also be nursing some injuries. And I think you've seen that post as well, Rob. There's a great, he's got quite a lot of content on Instagram. I'd recommend people follow him, actually, Cap215. But yeah, there's a great image of his ankle with two Calippos shoved down his sock, basically, getting the best combination of icing, cooling, and then, some kind of sloppy, sugary, molten Calippo for him to slurp at some point as well, presumably.
Lovely. Yeah. Sock ice cream, that's what we all want. Yeah. Especially on an ultra, like, oh, those feet are gonna pong, aren't they? Well, I mean, I did put in the notes here, hopefully Jorge George, sorry, Cap215 will be racing to make CP2, which closes tomorrow at 6 o'clock. But if you don't make CP1, maybe you won't be making that slog. Of course, if you miss a control point, you can still continue your ride. It does not stop you completing the race, and you might still complete it within your making the finishers party, but you will not get an official classified finish. But for a lot of people doing this, it's not necessarily about you're getting that stamp. I mean, obviously it's very important, but some people are here for the adventure.
He did make control point one. I'm talking rubbish.
He did.
He has made it.
Fantastic. So yeah, so okay, well, that changes things. So I think we should all be rooting for Cap215, and you know, he's currently, is he in Austria? Perhaps not. No, I think he's in Germany still, slogging his way towards Munich. So he's got quite a slog, but he's still got a good 12 hours to make the checkpoint, control point, sorry. So let's hope he makes CP2 tomorrow before it closes at 6 o'clock. And if anyone lives along his route out there in Germany or Austria, make sure you go out onto the road to cheer him on. Oh, that reminds me, we haven't spoke about dot watchers that just appear out of nowhere and scream at you on the road. Did you ever get that?
Yeah, I didn't get any screaming, but I had the few people kind of, show up and just join me for a bit of the ride. Obviously no drafting involved, but sometimes some people that were kind of out on their, you know, their regular ride anyway, and they had planned it to a route where they thought they might be able to pick off some TCR riders just for, you know, a bit of support and a bit of interest to their ride. But then a couple of others that had come out specifically, they'd seen that there was a dot relatively close to where they lived, and had come out. And it can be an amazing boost when you're having a low moment, because you can feel very alone out there, especially if you haven't seen other riders for a while. So yeah, it's a really cool feature of the race. And I think if I'm right, it seems like there have been some dot watchers on bikes out on the parkour today, getting some selfies on the go with, I'm not sure if it was Ulrich or Adam.
Yeah, I think it was Ulrich. There was a rider with him. So yeah, which is, you know, for those who don't know, you do get people who will go out of their way to, you know, like catch the riders, to give support, to cheer them on. I nearly crashed because of some dot watchers who had, because, you know, you're just riding along, you have no idea people are going to be there. And I take this corner, and there's a bunch of five people with like a TCR like banner, who just then scream like at me. And as completely not expecting it and nearly ditched it. Totally shocked me. Good boost.
got the adrenaline rush going.
Yeah, 100%. All right. So, right. Well, we had lots of listener questions this day. That's what it feels like, this race. Every day is a week. But we honed in on one listener, Nadine, who asked a few quite interesting key questions about pro riders, or what might be deemed a pro rider in a race, how this might change the race, and I guess just the whole notion of fairness and equality. I think me and Karen weren't really qualified to answer these questions, so we asked if Anna Haslock, the race director, could step in and give her thoughts on the Dean's questions. So we're going to duck out, and luckily Tom is riding with Anna somewhere on the road to Zagreb. So Tom was able to record Anna's response.
Hi, so I'll be answering some questions, listener questions. I'm actually a passenger in a car on our way to CP4. Therefore, if my voice sounds a bit odd at any point or there's some strange background noises, it's just the car. So the first question is, are professional racers allowed in the race? And the short answer is yes. The longer answer is LOSDOT are definitely going to be considering this more this year, because obviously the race is getting more popular, and I think we're getting more interest from semi-professional and possibly professional riders. And while that's super exciting for us and for our audience and riders, it also has implications for fairness, so we certainly want to make sure that we are careful about that, and we'll certainly be having discussions after the race this year and coming up with some solutions that we'll let you know about when we can.
Secondly, if a control point opens when the first rider passes it and it remains open for a certain number of hours thereafter, doesn't a strong, i.e. a pro rider, spoil the achievements of the others and also make it less inclusive? And are there different openings, I assume that's, are there different control point openings for female and pair riders?
Okay, so question number two. So at the moment, when the race first started, it was purely amateur races. And now the race is adapting, you know, different kind of people are attracted to the race. And so, of course, the race has to adapt the way we manage the race and the way we kind of facilitate the race in order to make sure that we're as fair and accommodating and inclusive as we can be, whilst also being, you know, the kind of gold standard blue ribbon race that everybody wants to enter. So there's two sides to the coin. There's, you know, of course we want to be inclusive and not discourage amateur races from joining. I think everybody can see that LOSDOT care very much about being inclusive, and we're working on that. So, you know, we've got some work to do to balance that with how we, you know, encourage the fastest races, and, you know, we've got some hard discussions and some hard decisions to make. So you make a good point, and it's something for us to really talk about over the coming weeks and months. We'll make some decisions and get back to you all.
So a couple there about pro riders and how that affects the race. And then a third question, essentially asking if you're not a privileged European, USA, Canada passport holder, i.e. For example, someone with a refugee status, how much assistance would there be to help you participate in the race?
So we have the Mike Hall Bursary, which we started in 2019. Obviously, we weren't able to actually action it until 2022 because of COVID. But, you know, that the Mike Hall Bursary was set up to assist riders from backgrounds or from a situation where, you know, they don't have access to a lot of finances and resources. And we offer a financial bursary to enter the, to, you know, to be able to, so you get a free entry to the race, you get a financial bursary to cover some of the costs of racing, and you also get some gifts from our race partners. So that's what we have at the moment. If anybody has any feedback regarding anything else that they feel that we could or should be offering, we're always open to feedback, advice, suggestions. So, you know, please get in touch via email is the best way, race@transcontinental.cc. If you've got any suggestions for anything more we can be doing, you know, we want to do the most and the best we can to be as accessible as we can be, and to be as diverse as we can be. I know we're starting from, the bar is really low, but at the moment, so we've got a lot of work to do, we know that, but you know, we're passionate about achieving and working hard and doing what we can, and we, you know, we need our community support to do that. So, you know, while we're working with turning the cogs to do some research on what more we could be doing, obviously we are also open to any advice and suggestions from our community.
So yeah, they were really good responses from Anna there, and good questions from Nadine. Yeah, the question of a fair playing field, which is the appeal of ultra racing. A lot of people love this type of racing because for a lot of people competing, they feel there is definitely, it's more than just being physically strong or being tough on the road and everything. So they've always felt ultras were a really good level playing field, and a good place where people who wouldn't necessarily be excellent in, you know, a criterium or, you know, a day race or something like that can actually excel at these, because there's a lot more that comes into them. Interestingly, I did follow up with from the Dean's questions and asked Anna if any pro riders have competed in the Transcontinental to date, and of course this brought up the question of, you know, what exactly defines a pro? So in this edition, we've heard from Sebastian, who, you know, he was the European and German MTB champ, which, you know, potentially could make him fall into the category of pro racer. There's also riders who aren't necessarily pro in a professional sense, as in riding for a team as such or having national champs under the belt, but are paid to ride the bike by various sponsors and as such in ultras. So there is a wider question of how do you define a pro, and then of course how do you, in the sense of keeping the race fair and in the interests of equality, you know, how do the race organizers police that, if indeed it is something that needs policing currently or in the future?
No, just that I think it's a super interesting question, and I think it, you know, it links into, I guess, also what you mentioned earlier about generally the field in ultra races is becoming increasingly experienced, and people, it's something that people are specializing in. I think there's a lot more kind of sponsorship and media focus on ultra racing as well. You've obviously got EF Education First riders riding things like GB Duro and so on. So I think it's increasingly a question that a lot of racers are going to have to wrangle with, essentially.
Whole definition of what a pro is, it doesn't necessarily mean world tour rider.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that wraps it up for this episode. We've covered a lot of ground. Definitely very excited for tomorrow to see where the races go from here. And hopefully we'll have Tom joining us.
Thanks for guiding us through though, Rob. It's been really good to chat about the last 24 hours in the race. And Tom, we hope you've made it to Zagreb and then on to wherever you're off to next, and we look forward to speaking with you tomorrow.
Brilliant. And don't forget, you can send in your questions about the Transcontinental for us to chat about in upcoming episodes. Send those in to race@transcontinental.cc with pod questions as a subject. Thank you very much, and that's it from me.
And that's it from me too.
This podcast is supported by our race partners, Apidura, Physique, Hutchinson, Kinesis, Komoot, LEM Helmets, and Pedaled. All the music has been created for this series by Joe Skinner.